they're going to be able to sail consistent with Florida law.
The court sides with Florida. Cruises get the go. No proof of vaccination required.
A new federal holiday, Juneteenth.
As I was growing up, and I would hear about Juneteenth.
A long time coming.
Be aware, be cognizant of what's going on.
Stealing home, the latest South Florida scam.
We learned of these three suspects through a series of deposits once the home was sold.
South Florida rabbis living a week of modern history in Israel.
There's tremendous optimism in the Jewish state right now because of it.
And coming back with stories that made headlines and some that did not.
Everyone has their own voice and everyone has their own story to tell.
A packed hour ahead, all live this week in South Florida.
Good morning. Glad you could join us. I'm Michael Putnam.
I'm Glenna Milberg. We begin with a South Florida member of Congress with a front row seat to history this week as the day the last enslaved people in the then yet to be United States became an 11th federal holiday. Juneteenth celebrations are underway this weekend, even as this country and this community struggle with issues of racism and discrimination.
Front and center at the White House for the bill signing on Juneteenth on the holiday, Representative Frederica Wilson, and she is a Democrat from Miami, joins us now from home with one of her signature hats. Congresswoman, good morning. Great to see
good
you.
Good morning.
Good morning. I can barely hear you.
We'll talk loud for you, Congresswoman. You're a woman of that wears many hats. That's a beautiful one. And at the signing for the Juneteenth federal holiday, you were wearing a pink one. Was pink a color? I noticed everybody was wearing pink. Was there? I just want to start out by acknowledging, what was all the pink?
Why was everyone wearing pink?
Okay, we are having some technical difficulties. Is there a way that the Congresswoman can sort of hear us on better audio?
Yeah, maybe we can.
Well, Glenna, I think you asked me about why was I wearing what I was wearing.
Close enough.
I was wearing an African outfit or African hat from Nigeria. I'm an African queen in Nigeria. I was crowned by the Nigerians for the Bring Back Our Girls. So I have lots of African attire, and because of Juneteenth, to commemorate it, I've been wearing my hats, my African attire.
That's a great story.
Yeah. Congresswoman, I hope you can hear us a little bit better. We will try an RN. Maybe whoever your staff is there can boost your audio as well. But let's get to the basic question here. Juneteenth, obviously 156 years after the news came to the slaves there in Galveston, Texas, that black people were free, they had been emancipated. What was your thought? What was going through your mind as you stood there in the White House on Thursday and watched the president sign this bill?
It was just amazing because, you know, every day I walk across the street to the Capitol and I look up at the dome and I know how many slaves died building the Capitol and erecting the dome. And I know how many slaves died building the White House. So there I was in the White House that slaves built, just a few feet from where President Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. And I just cried. I was crying. I was crying and smiling and laughing, and the emotions were just overwhelming. It was a wonderful, wonderful day and a wonderful time to be alive and to be serving in Congress and witness such a beautiful accomplishment. And the woman who has been the champion behind this bill for 30 years was there with us, Ms. Lee from Galveston, Texas. So proud.
Congresswoman, I want to pick up on something you just said, that Juneteenth is a holiday. Actually, many states have recognized it as a holiday for decades. It's been celebrated, I know you mentioned, by your family your whole life. Geographically, outside the South, in the northern states, not a lot of people knew about Juneteenth. And for such a significant day in Black history, what does that say about Black history education right now?
It says that Black history is excluded from the textbooks of our nation. And when I was on the school board, I personally did everything that I could to put African-American history in the Florida textbooks, and we succeeded. And now, I don't know what happened, but I don't see it anymore. And I started in our Dade County public school system. We had an advocate in every school who was teaching African-American history. And this is something that has to be spread across the nation, because the way that people get along and the way that you have peace is you learn the history of your own people, and then you learn the history of others. And then there's that respect that's built. But African-American history has simply been excluded, and it's wrong, and it needs to be changed.
Yeah. Congressman, we want to get to critical race theory later and the teaching of racism in this country. But I would point out, to follow up on Glenna's question, that according to a Gallup poll, 37% of Americans, just 37%, say they know something now about Juneteenth. Certainly in the future, a lot of people are going to learn. May I ask you, what did you do yesterday to observe Juneteenth as a national federal holiday?
Well, yesterday I had the opportunity to receive the key to the city in the North Miami Beach. And there were role model boys there. And we talked about Juneteenth. And the gentleman who gave me the key to the city are graduates of the role models. They're both attorneys now, and they serve on the city council of North Miami Beach. So there were children there, lots of children. They were painting, they were making candles, and they invited me to talk about Juneteenth to them. Now, this was prior to the signing of the bill. We didn't even know that the bill was going to be signed, but I was invited to talk about Juneteenth. And so I spent the holidays speaking to them. I went down to Pride in Wynwood. I spoke to them about Juneteenth. I went to Miami Gardens to their Juneteenth celebration. I spoke to everyone about it. And so, being an educator, I spent my day educating the public about Juneteenth and how it is so important that President Biden signed that bill. And I have one of the pens that he used to sign it, because it signifies the end to slavery. And because he did that, it will become a conversation across the nation, just like Veterans Day, just like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. So people will talk about it. And as they talk about it, they will learn about it. And our children will know about it. And they should know about it, all children.
Congresswoman, I just want to throw out there that your enthusiasm and your deep appreciation is kind of contagious. It's really so wonderful to sit here and listen and absorb what you're talking about. Right now on social media, there is actually a debate about the symbolism of Juneteenth, as wonderful as it is to have it as a national holiday, shouldn't compare, shouldn't replace, shouldn't be instead of something more substantive, policies, instead of policies that some consider voter suppression, especially for Black people. What do you say to those who are on social media right now saying, yeah, great, a holiday, but what are they really doing for us?
Well, what I say is African-American people don't get a lot of wins. We are not recognized often. And when we are, we have to celebrate. We need to celebrate, but we don't stop fighting. We cannot stop fighting, but we have to pause and we have to savor this moment, because this is a wonderful time in the history of our nation. Sure, we're going to continue to vote, to fight for voting rights, We're going to continue to make sure that all of our children are educated. We're going to continue to fight for police reform. We're not going to stop. But yesterday, we stopped.
Yeah. Congresswoman, we understand. We don't expect you or Black people to stop at all. Let me ask you, there were 14 members of the House of Representatives where you sat who voted against this, a 14 Republican white men, I should say, as a matter of fact. Some of them said, we don't really need a holiday to compete with July 4th. That is our National Independence Day, and now people are going to look at Juneteenth and say, why do we have two Independence Days? What's your answer to him?
Well, we had two Independence Times, and at that time, we were not even considered. So those 14 men, it didn't matter what was passed, they were going to oppose it. Anything that the Democrats pass, they're going to oppose it. So I'm not going to let any 14 men dampen the joy of Juneteenth.
Congresswoman, can you sit tight for us for 2 minutes? We're going to take a quick break and be right back for more.
On This Week in South Florida, on this Father's Day, we are talking to Congresswoman Frederica Wilson of Miami. Congresswoman, you have spent your entire adult life as an educator. You were school principal. You were on the Miami-Dade School Board and the legislature. You fought for education funding. And now in Florida, a new law has been passed, signed by the governor, that says that critical race theory may not be taught in Florida schools. And really what they are saying is that the history of racism in this country, the theory that somehow it permeates all American institutions, should not be taught children, because the governor says that is cultural Marxism. What is your response to the governor?
I say that the governor should be ashamed of himself. And he should be ashamed of himself because he doesn't know his history. And if he did, he would not be vetoing anything in regards to what should be taught in public schools. I do believe, however, that with the passage of Juneteenth, with the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. birthday, I believe that we have tipped the consciousness of young people, especially Black children in our state, and our millennials. And now they are woke, and they know that they have a history. So there will be questions. And whenever their children are asking questions, teachers have to answer those questions.
Right. Well, so let me just, if I may.
They've got to do their research in order to be accurate and pass on the right information. Right. And you can teach without the governor giving you permission to teach.
Right. Excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I have to say, when you were a school principal, if one of your teachers had come to you at this moment and said, gee, you know, Principal Wilson, I want to tell my sixth graders, eighth graders about the lynching at Emmett Till. I want to tell them, you know, the history of things that happened, some ugly racist incidents in our state, but I'm afraid that I may break the law. What would you tell that teacher?
I would say teach, teachers, teach. You teach the truth. That is your job as a teacher. And no one is going to be monitoring teachers in the classroom as they teach. What the only thing they can monitor is materials that's purchased with state money, state adopted curriculum. But what you say to your students, especially those students who ask you questions, then it's just fine. And that's what I would tell every teacher in the state of Florida.
You know, at the moment, the teaching, the debate over teaching what's called critical race theory is nationwide, not just in Florida, as you know. And I wonder if that the name of that curriculum and the sort of past of it, because that's something from decades ago that is now in the public consciousness. I wonder if that was sort of repackaged and renamed as history, if you want, but it, sort of like Holocaust education, because the same people who are debating in opposition to critical race theory are very much supportive of Holocaust education, which is a very ugly time for current day Germans to grapple with. Do you see any sort of comparison on packaging critical race theory or another sort of name to Black history? And what is truly an ugly history of this country to what the Germans deal with in Holocaust education?
I think that people do sometimes, we package things the wrong way. And I think that the term critical race theory is self-explanatory. It's critical, and it's a theory of race. And I think that as we explain it across the country, we have to explain it just like that. It applies to how race has impacted society, race relations, racial barriers, all of the inequities that impact African-American people. Racism, lynching, redlining, segregation, all sorts of things that have been put in place by governments, federal government, state governments, local governments, to hinder the progress of African-American people. And that's what it is. That's what it's called, and that's what it means.
Yeah.
Critical race theory.
Yeah. Congresswoman, you had a moment with President Biden there at the White House. I think it goes without saying, he would not have been the Democratic nominee, would not be the president without Black votes. I mean, South Carolina gave him the nomination, Black voters in South Carolina, and helped elect him last November. Do you think in some ways signing this and making the comments he made is an acknowledgement of his debt to Black voters in this country?
Well, I sure hope it is. if it wasn't his intent, that's the way I perceive it. And I don't think that President Biden has to say thank you to the Black community any more than the American Rescue Plan and all of the transportation and infrastructure bills that he's trying to push through, and how he's trying to push through voting rights and help with all of the indicators that's gonna make the African-American community whole. So it just so happened that President Biden was not the engineer of Juneteenth. Juneteenth emanated in the Senate, and once it passed in the Senate and got to the House, we threw it over to the president and he signed it. So let's don't get confused. Now, that was not President Biden's idea.
Inside story is always important. Congresswoman, before we let you go, I want to do a little sea change at the moment because there was big news this week. The courts actually sided with Governor DeSantis in Florida against pretty stringent CDC rulings for cruise ships to restart, and some are actually this week. I'm just going to let everyone know, we tried very hard to get some of the cruise industry professionals and maritime lawyers to join us to explain what on earth this all means. From your perch on a federal level, CDC guidelines are about to change. Cruise ships are about to begin in Florida. We won't know who and who is not vaccinated aboard. Weigh in on that for us, if you would.
Well, Glenna, I chair the Florida Ports Caucus. I've been chairing that Ports Caucus now for 8 years.
Yeah.
And so I deal with the cruise industry and the ports. And our governor is, I don't want to insult him, but that's a dumb idea.
Well, the courts actually are supporting the governor this week.
Who
is supporting the governor?
The court ruled the governor and the state had asked for an injunction against the CDC requirements. And this week, a court sided with Florida, with the governor, and said, we're gonna wait a month, but the CDC now has 2 weeks to come back with not mandates, but guidelines, a softening of what CDC wanted to happen.
Well, I think that everyone, if you want my opinion, everyone who goes on a cruise should be vaccinated. I think 80% of the people in America, if you did a poll, would say the same thing. So I would be very careful about going on a cruise. It doesn't matter what a lawsuit says or anyone else says. And if I was in the cruise industry, I would make sure that everyone who set sail on a cruise ship that I owned would be vaccinated.
Well, we would like to go on a cruise on the cruise ship that you own, but in the meantime, Congresswoman Frederica Wilson, always good speaking with you, and congratulations to you for your work on behalf of Juneteenth.
Thanks, Congresswoman.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, next, who owns your home? Property owner should be checking because of the latest Florida real estate scam, and you're going to meet one of the victims who turned the tables. Next. South Florida's real estate has always been a ripe target for scammers.
Late this week, there were arrests in a scam we first reported. Criminals who fake signatures and deeds, steal and resell your home or properties without you ever knowing. And that's what happened to Shirley Gibson of Coconut Grove. She and her attorney, David Winker, are with us now to unravel how this happened to her and have us all racing to check our own property records. Good morning. Great to have you.
Ms. Gibson, great to see you. David Winker, old friend, nice to see you as well.
Good morning. So nice to be here. So nice to be here with Ms. Gibson and be with you guys. I've been watching this show for years. A real pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you, David. Ms. Gibson, we have reported fairly extensively on Local 10 about how you were affected by this scam. If you would sort of briefly take us how you found out that this valuable piece of property you inherited from your grandfather in Coconut Grove, how you learned that in fact it had been stolen from you.
Well, when I went to pay my taxes, good morning, in March, I found out that someone else had paid the taxes. And I told the cashier that I didn't pay them and I didn't give anyone consent to pay them, and I did not sell my property. And it escalated from there. And I left the tax office, walked outside, and went to the Grove, and I contacted David, Mr. Winter.
They had given her actually a copy of the fraudulent deed. The clerk's office gave her the deed, and she showed it to me. And you know, the first question I had was, is this your signature? It looked like my 8-year-old's, you know, block print signature. And, you know, she was like, of course, no, it's not. So, you know, what do we do next?
I think we have actually a photograph of that. You're right. That signature, we all could have told it was fraudulent right away. But, David, there it is. We're looking at it now. I'm not sure you can see it. We're also looking at the beginning of a warranty deed. So this is a claim to the house. And so while we talk about how this scam works, David, this is sort of happening to seniors, older people, because that's more likely the people who will own their home outright without a mortgage. It's their home. Obviously, when they got to this property in Ms. Gibson, they had no idea who they were dealing with. They just didn't know.
Yeah.
And so,
well, I think that's, yes,
well, you went to the police. What was their reaction? I mean, how this just seems like something there should be so many stopgaps and such oversight for. And people are saying, how on earth could that happen?
So it's interesting, Glenna. You know, one of the issues here is, I think that when I do internet transactions with internationals, they can't believe how easy and transparent and online our system is, right? It's much easier to transfer property in America probably than any other country. And then the downside to that is if you're a crook or a bad guy, you can take advantage of that. And I think that's an example here. So I think that I would recommend everyone don't take comfort in that you have to have a mortgage to be protected. Everyone should take the steps that we're going to talk about. But I think it's really key. It is targeting elderly, and it's targeting these lots. And frankly, it's part of it's a symptom of our overheated market, right? These lots are so valuable. And the thing about a lot is, you know, no one's going to buy a house without inspecting it, right? But a lot, you know, the person would say, well, I can't meet with you. You know, I have COVID, or I'm concerned about COVID, but I'll send you a notarized deed. You know, it's believable with a lot, but with a house, it's not going to happen. So, you know, at the press conference with State Attorney Catherine Fernandez Rundle, you know, they talked about there was 50 plus similar cases of this that were, you know, going on. So it's, you know, it's going to continue to happen.
Okay, let me just stop you there for one moment. 50 similar cases. And I just want to let that sink in for a while. Because at that press conference, the state attorney also announced that there is going to be a task force now to address this. Why now? If they had 50 cases, where has law enforcement been on this? No disrespect to our friends in law enforcement, but this seems like something someone should have been focused upon before Shirley Gibson came forward.
Well, I would say two things about that. One, we had, and I should let Ms. Gibson talk about it, because we had a very positive experience with law enforcement. They were all over this. They took it seriously. And then I have to tell you, Glenna, like, you know, we made a big point of thanking the media, because you guys grabbed onto the story, and it's part of the public service that the media does, right? Bringing attention to something like this and the widespread nature of it. And I think this particularly resonates with people with who it's happening to.
Okay, but I want to go back. I don't want to let that go, if you would. I don't want to let that go, because prior to media involvement, there were 50 cases. So where was the attention to this before we discovered it?
I think that, yeah, the last thing I would say about it is I was happy to work with Ms. Gibson. I think Ms. Gibson, I'm not going to say how old Ms. Gibson is on TV, but, you know, I think that she is an older person with a fighting spirit. And I think that many of those cases that happened to people who couldn't fight back in an effective way. I don't know. I mean, people have been reaching out to me to help with those cases. And so I don't know the particulars of it. And it's interesting, because I think part of me as a lawyer, like, you know, I know where you're going with it. And I almost like, I'm just happy that people are dealing with it now. I think, honestly, Glenna, I would put it into the context of the COVID. I think one of the reasons this is happening is, you know, people were more accepting of, oh, you're not going to show up at the closing. Well, we can do it this way.
Yeah.
So I think that this has all happened in the last, you know, like it has been maybe the last 6 months, those 50 cases. But I will tell you, in defense of law enforcement, like, they were really, you know, on our case. So I can only speak to our case, but we were very happy with how they were.
Yeah. Ms. Gibson, you are 86 and still a formidable person. You're a tough customer. I say that with admiration. But you certainly got a lot of good help from David Winker from the Miami Police Department, from Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava, was at that news conference the other day, and especially from Miami-Dade State Attorney Catherine Fernandez Rundle. So you have all the right people on your side. How close are you now to being the legal owner once again of this property that's been in your family for, what, 100 years?
Yes. Been in my family for over 100 years. And my attorney will have to address how close we are to getting.
I think, Michael, it's a good question, because it is not in her name. And it was interesting, because as part of the law enforcement effort, Ms. Gibson was on top of me also and asking me, like, hey, Dave, like, you're doing a great job, but when do I get my property back? And it's still not in her name, but it will be transferred over.
And I think while we're talking about this, it's important to note that Ms. Gibson is the ultimate victim in this case, but the title company and the actual developer who thought that they were buying the property, even the notary public whose name was forged, there are so many more victims in this one case as well.
No, and I would tell you that, remember, somebody is still out $230,000. In this case, it's the title insurance company. So one thing I would say to you is, you know, this was bought by a reputable company, right? There was a third party company in New York that bought it. And they immediately, when I first thing we did was we went to the police. So that's one thing I would tell people, go to the police. Second of all, I contacted the closing agent, who was listed right on the deed, right on the top of the deed. It says who closed the deal. And I told them about it. He's a very reputable person. And he immediately, I'm telling you, within 5 minutes, Glenna, I received an email from him CCing his client to the title insurance company saying, we're making a claim, like there's something wrong here. And so basically the buyer is gonna get reimbursed the money and transfer the property back to us. The bad deed will be null and void. But the point is the insurance company, you know, they paid probably $5,000 of title insurance and they received their money back. It's a lesson in why you should have title insurance. I don't care if you're buying $5,000 a lot, but you know, so basically that's who's left. That is who's left holding the bag here.
Yeah.
All right, well, David Winker, thank you very much. Ms. Gibson, thank you very much for being with us. Watch out, David, you're gonna give lawyers a good name. Keep up the good work.
You know what? We have one more question from Ms. Gibson. So if you sit tight, we'll be right back. We are back with Shirley Gibson and her attorney, David Winker, who discovered that Ms. Gibson's property was stolen by scammers. Three people are now under arrest for that. Ms. Gibson, in the short time we have together, that property that's been in your family for more than 100 years in the Grove, I just want to take the opportunity, this moment that we have together, and I want to hear from you. You're one of the pioneering Miami families in that Grove neighborhood, built by Bahamians more than 100 years ago, that is now so targeted by developers as valuable land. Just take a couple of minutes. Give us the TV version of your family history in the Grove.
Well, my great-grandmother, Sophronia Higgs, came here in 1879. I'm not sure if she came from Key West up to Coconut Grove. And then my grandmother came here from Eleuthera in 1904. And he bought a lot of property during his era. And it was passed down to my father and from my father to me. And I still have some of the property.
Do developers call you a lot?
Well, it started back in November of last year when a realtor called me and said he would like to buy my lot. And I told him it was not for sale, but he still said that someone by the name of Shirley Gibson is selling the property. He said it was a man. I said, well, I am Shirley Gibson and I'm a female and I own the property and I'm not selling it. And it just escalated from there.
Yeah. Ms. Gibson, sort of explained to me, I knew when I first moved to Miami as a reporter, Father Theodore Gibson in the Grove. I became good friends with Father Gibson, and Thelma Gibson went on to be, you know, a Miami commissioner, the first black nurse at Jackson Memorial Hospital. I mean, it's really a remarkable family. That's all part of your family, are they not?
No, we're not related.
No, they're not, really?
There's a lot of Gibsons.
Other Gibsons.
So David, take the last word. Give your best lawyerly advice to every property owner and homeowner listening to this program right now, how to avoid being a victim of this really, what seems like an easy scam to perpetrate.
I think it's important. Everyone needs to plug in. If you're elderly or if you're a caretaker for an elderly, do it on their behalf. Ms. Gibson's a retired librarian. So she's very computer savvy. She's actually was the one that looked up who had bought it, this, you know, the development company that had bought it. You know, she was very good at looking at it, and it even happened to her. So quarterly, check Miami-Dade. Second of all, I would encourage everyone to get a credit monitoring service. They will do that as part of your property. That's why if you have a mortgage, like most of us do, you don't have to worry about this, because they're going to, the bank has a monitoring service, and the minute there's a lien on your property, a transfer, anything, you get an immediate warning.
Thank you so much. You know, that's the beauty of This Week in South Florida. We free legal advice right here. So great for you all to be with us. So good to see
you.
And thanks so much.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Next, a firsthand report on the current situation in Israel from a South Florida rabbi who was just there.
He has a report that you will not see anywhere else. And that's up next.
This week, incendiary balloons that were launched from Gaza into Israel threatened to end a fragile ceasefire after nearly 2 weeks of violent clashes.
A group of 18 rabbis from South Florida on a friendship mission there experienced more than they were expecting. Rabbi Andrew Jacobs of Plantations Ramat Shalom Synagogue was documenting it all real time almost on social media. He is back in the time zone and with us live today. Hi, Rabbi.
Hey, Rabbi. How are you?
I'm good. I'm a little bit more rested than the last time we spoke.
Well, you were there 7 hours ahead. You know, this we have a short time together today, but when we talked, one of the things that I was really struck by, and I think other people who are hearing from all the rabbis who were there, is you were on a friendship mission. One of your first trips was to the Gaza border, and you met in a school with Palestinian Israelis and Israelis from all, I mean, it's such a diverse community there. What don't we see in the United States in the headlines that are typically us versus them or him versus her? What don't we see?
What we don't see, what we don't hear is that there are many Israelis. And when I say Israelis, I mean Jews, I mean Arabs, I mean Palestinians, I mean Christians, et cetera, who are not sharing stories of hate, not sharing stories of anger or resentment, but sharing that they want to learn to build society together. There are so many of the stories that we come back with that highlight that. And it's unfortunate that we don't hear more of those stories, because I think those are the stories that need to be heard and then fostered by the world, because that is what's going to make a difference on the ground in Israel.
Yeah. Rabbi Jacobs, I think on your second day, I know this because my rabbi, Jonathan Birkin, was on the trip with you from Aventura, that you went to the city of Lod, where, in fact, Israel, Jews, Arabs, Christians, everybody had essentially had some kind of peaceful coexistence. But when this fighting broke out, I mean, the civil society sort of ruptured in Lod. So what did you find there?
So Lod was pretty, it was a very intense and emotional experience. We visited with one of the rabbis in Lod, whose synagogue was actually burned, and many of his community members faced an attack. And we also visited with Principal Shireen Hafi, who's the principal. She is a Palestinian Israeli. She's the principal of the Arab school there. And what we learned from the principal was that she is committed to rebuilding the city of Lod as with her Jewish neighbors. She spoke with us and a few of her students and said that there's no room for anything but love, that if we love each other, we're not going to commit this type of violence. The rabbi that we met with was also right after the riots in Lod. He went to the Hinam Center, which is a social tolerance center in Israel, and he met with Muslim leaders trying to figure out how the Jewish community there can move forward. Again, these messages of moving forward, as we say in Hebrew, bayachad, you know, hand in hand together, they don't make it onto the news. The violence makes it there, and to see that that both sides are committed to working together to accept the fact that this horror happened in their city. That has to be accepted. We can't ignore it. But then to figure out how to overcome that, if we can do that and support those the various different members of the LODE community, that is going to make a difference.
And on another level of that, Israel has a new government. And if people think the United States government is messy, they should take a look at, which I'm not sure I even understand yet, but this new coalition government, the most diverse Arabs are part of the party and parcel of this government, Israelis of liberal, moderate, and conservative stripe. And you met with the new president-elect and some members of that. How did that go?
We did. You know, what we hear from the Israeli leaders is that there is great hope because of the diversity. I mean, Israel's 73 years old, and for the first time in 73 years old, there is an Islamic party in the leading coalition. There's more women than ever. There's members of the right, members of the left. Even someone who's hard of hearing was just sworn in using sign language. So there is tremendous potential. I think as we see in our own country, there are the naysayers, but there's a lot of people who have hope that this government might just hold the key to slowly bringing about more harmony and promoting the stories that my colleagues and I got to see on the ground.
Yeah. Rabbi, as you well know, we in the news media, we concentrate on things when they don't go the way you hope they should, and when there is violence, clashes, confrontations. So that is what we all in this country have seen over the last 6 weeks or so. But what I'm getting from you is that there is a sense of hope and optimism that you saw there during your 3 days, your intense 3 days in Israel.
You know, we went there with the hope. We have, each of the rabbis have a love for Israel, and we went there to share our love with Israelis because we felt such a disconnect during this difficult time. I did not return home expecting to have felt the love that I felt there. And yes, that was incredibly uplifting. I don't want to belittle the fact that there are serious problems. There's serious trauma in the country. There's still violence in the country. But the love that we experienced there lifted my heart. And I am returning committed to promoting that narrative that Israelis of all different backgrounds and religious backgrounds, they do care about each other. And we need to talk about that and support it.
Well, Rabbi Jacobs, I think that you have our commitment to talk about whatever is good as well as bad. And we certainly thank you and everyone else for sharing those stories.
But we thank you for highlighting our journey. It means a lot to all of us.
Thank you so much. And we'll be right back.
Thank you for being here on this Father's Day edition of This Week South Florida. Happy Father's Day, Daddy. We are online 24/7. Remember, at local10.com.
As always, stay informed, get involved, and have a great Father's Day.